I'm truly honored that you've invited me and touched. There's much I want to talk to you about this afternoon. Our time together here these past 4 years, what you have learned, and more importantly, what you may not have learned. And what we, your teachers, have sought to teach you, and what, in failures of imagination, or experience, or politics, we may have failed to teach you. I want also to touch on the different worlds you and I grew up in, and how these may have shaped us differently. But before all this, I want you to think with me about what is ahead of you. Today, you begin one of the truly major transitions in life, to a time when you will be substantially responsible for yourselves, seeking a vocation, or at least a bearably decent job, and a lifelong loving partner. Many of you will spend the remainder of your 20s searching, and in some anxiety, states, I would argue, critical to sustain if you are to find a satisfying place in your life. Such times of search can be adventures, but they often have their desperate moments, times of feeling lost, anxieties about whether one will ever find one's way. A simple but terrifying question may characterize them. How should I live? I can venture here something of my own experience, but most of all, I'm going to turn to three, for me, of the greatest American writers, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, and William James's essay entitled, Is Life Worth Living? It is James I turn to first. James was one of those who took a long time finding his vocation, as I hope many of you will do. But some of you may find his story a too vivid version of your worst apprehensions, or worse, a confirmation of the rightness of how pushed and pressured many of you have been since as early as preschool, as though getting into college, or at least the right college, was indispensable to a good life. And that rushing on from Amherst to the next overly structured school or environment is the unavoidable and right next step, maybe for two of you. To those who want to settle their lives so prematurely, it might seem a risky interruption, a waste, after all, to ask, in a sustained way, what is all this for? Such eager anxiety to be settled could, after all, be resolved most directly and simply by graduating and going to visit the local funeral home. No risks, no agonies, no struggle. It's done with it. We should, as well, wonder what kinds of human beings worth having are likely to emerge from such lemming-like competitiveness and anxiety. For most of us, what vocational choices could or should be trusted when we are 22 and largely without any experience outside of school? Do I want to go to a doctor who went to medical school at 22? Bloody unlikely. William James took this his time, often in great unhappiness. He never went to college, as few did in his time. He showed talent as a painter early on, and at 17 decided that was his vocation over his strong-willed father's vehement objections. He studied for 2 years with one of the leading American painters. His surviving drawings show considerable talent. Then, at 19, he decided to pursue scientific studies at the Lawrence Scientific School, at the time a subordinate part of Harvard, because experimental science was, after all, too vocational. At 22, he decided science as such was too impractical, and he enrolled at Harvard Medical School. 1 year later, he took a leave of absence to accompany the great naturalist Louis Agassiz on a year-long expedition to Brazil. Repeated illnesses, a bout of blindness which lasted for a month, and cataloging specimens ended that. No career there, he says. Back to Harvard Medical School. Out again 1 year later to go to Germany to study experimental neurology, then a new field. He finally received his MD 5 years after starting what was then a 3-year program. But James had already decided not to practice medicine, returning to his first impressions of it, I quote, "There is much humbug, and that, with the exception of surgery, a doctor does more by the moral effect of his presence on the patient and family than by anything else. He also extracts money from them." He never practiced medicine. Now, with time on his hands, he read extensively, suffered from a prolonged depression, contemplated suicide, But finally, in 1872, and entirely by accident, he finds his career. Charles William Eliot, the new president of Harvard, asks him to teach as a kind of adjunct, one time only, an undergraduate comparative anatomy course. He is 30 years old at this point. But from this complex and prolonged beginning, he becomes one of the creators of the modern field of psychology, including its experimental side, a prolific writer. His first book, The Two-Volume, The Principles of Psychology, remains not only a classic with pertinence still to the field of psychology, but in literature, it is so beautifully written. Then he changes fields again, as soon as he publishes what is the major text for many years after, and founds one of the great departments of philosophy in the modern academy. He himself becomes one of the greatest American philosophers, a giant figure yet in Anglo-American philosophy. Now, I can't promise you that if you take until you're 30, you'll do as well. But the chances go up each year. Back now briefly to his essay, Is Life Worth Living? A digest and reflection on his years of searching for his life's work. And to the question which inevitably follows, if it is worth living, how do we live it to make it so? Why should we even entertain his first harrowing question? You will know some of the conventional ways of answering that first question, such as the proverbial, the unexamined life is not worth living. True a response as this may be, it has always struck me as finally too pious and glib. James's question cuts to the bone, and at some moment of crisis, we must wonder how to live so as to make it worth it to live. To choose to live is not simply to refuse self-extinction, but to embrace life, to make decisions about purpose, about engaging in the everyday with all of one's senses popping, to seek adventures outward and inner. It is, to quote an old great African-American spiritual, to wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's going to trouble the water. And hear James on the matter. He asks, what ought to be everyone's object in life? To be as much use as possible, he answers. But what is use? Analyze any useful invention or the life of any useful man or woman, and you will see that its or his or her use consists in some pleasure, mental or bodily, conferred upon humanity. Suppose that food and clothing and shelter were assured to everyone. What man or woman would then be held in honor? Not only the constructors of bridges and tunnels, the inventors of steam engines and spinning jennies, but all those who afforded some pleasure to others, whether material or spiritual. And in such a state of society, every man or woman would follow out his or her own tastes and excel as much as possible in the particular line for which he or she was created. It is then the duty of everyone to do as much good as possible. Pleasure is the striking word in this passage, especially because of its coupling with use. My use, or your use, according to James, consists of conferring some pleasure on others, on humanity, to, quote, do as much good as possible. We are to do so by first discovering the particular line, read talent or ability, for which we were created. Find your vocations. Find your talents. And when you do, devote them, whatever they may be, to the good of humankind. If James is right in his instructions, and I believe he is, you will then simultaneously attain great pleasure yourself while you're also giving it to others. Thoreau, like James in resolving to make life worth living, goes to Walden out of a determination, he tells us, to free himself of depression by living deliberately. He puts the matter aggressively in these famous words, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner. every one of those words counts, not just on a page. Living is so dear. Keep these words with you. Life is costly. But Thoreau also means something simpler, I think, here than we might assume. Living is so dear because each day of our lives we spend a part of it down. Its very finitude gives it its preciousness. What we experience today is gone tomorrow forever, except as memory. Why waste it, he asks, at a different point, by, quote, getting and spending? Why indeed? And Emerson, the shaping influence for both Thoreau and James, speaks similarly, if more impatiently. This is from his essay on experience. Life is a series of surprises and would not be worth taking or keeping if it were not. God delights to isolate us every day and hide from us the past and the future. We would look about us, but with grand politeness, he draws down before us an impenetrable screen of purest sky and another behind us of purest sky. You will not remember, he seems to say, and you will not expect. All good conversation, manners, and action comes from a spontaneity which forgets usages and makes the moment great. Nature hates calculators. All of these writers understand that what makes life worth living cannot be separated from the question of what it means to be a free woman or man. What is required to live as a free person is precisely to engage these questions, and thus to be a part of the ongoing making of a genuine democracy. Because it is with these questions we cannot forget that whatever else separates us, we are fundamentally equal. The lives you are about to engage may be heightened and profoundly altered if you heed the words and experiences of these three American thinkers. Mine certainly has been. I would not have wanted to live without them. If you take nothing else from Amherst, take their books, read them, and keep them by you. But, as in all pastimes, you also bring into the present and into the futures you hope to make not only your own ambitions, desires, and histories, but the history of your nation and of the contemporary world. Human beings may make history, as Karl, not Tony Marx, says, but not just in the way we want. No one but a fool could lightly read or dismiss the histories you carry already on your backs. Simply because of the luck of my birth, and I must stress luck, there is no merit or moral desert in what I'm about to say to you. I came of age at the time of the Civil Rights Movement and the mass efforts to end the war in Vietnam, a time when often naively people like me believed we could fundamentally change the country. I still believe that, by the way, but I was naive about what it would take. It was also a generation of unprecedented economic growth and abundance. Almost all Americans were substantially better off than a generation earlier. I knew of no one in my college years who thought or cared or worried much about jobs or admissions to graduate schools. The future was there for the taking. Why bother worrying about it? This is not a luxury you have ever had. Of course, this did not last, but the sense of openness and possibility marked every one of us then, including the large majority of my contemporaries who, despite mythology, never showed up for a single demonstration, let alone doing a damn other thing. The luck of your births has a more shadowed and a more handicapped quality. From the 1970s forward, a massively financed reaction against the achievements of the 60s was mounted by corporations and other segments of the American elite. Over time, among other attacks on our democracy, this reaction engendered a revulsion against politics and engendered a widespread belief that nothing of substance could be changed in the United States. No greater offense has been committed against your generation than this or its corollary, which is that, that one can only be effective working as an individual for oneself, and occasionally charitably giving service to those less fortunate. that nothing, in short, can be done to examine and alter the structures grounding the deepest social and economic problems as though they'd not been created by other human beings. The response to these anti-democratic legacies is simple. Change only comes when people gather together in common cause, the politics without which no democracy can be sustained. Provoking and organizing a renewed belief in democratic politics, and I don't mean the Democratic Party, are matters of hard work, patience, and faith. Doing so and achieving greater justice has many twists and turns, but the activity itself is life-giving and expanding, and it urgently needs doing if a fundamental fabric of decency is to be restored in the United States. Some of you have already begun such work. It is my deepest hope for all of you that you will lend your energies and talents not simply to alleviating the symptoms of inequality, but to moving at the grassroots politically to radical reform of all that has created our many inequalities. You will not be alone. Many have gone before you in such work, and their legacies matter. They remain in achievements and in missteps to be learned from and built on. Let me here name four such democratic reformers from whom I have learned much and been much inspired. And some of these names are not as well known as they ought to be. Ella Baker, Robert Moses, Fannie Lou Hamer, all of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and Miles Horton, the founder of the Highlander School. You can study and read or read about them all to much benefit. All were or are teachers, but almost never within conventional schools and classrooms. And then, by the luck of your birth, there's September 11th, 2001. Most of you were first-year students in high school. I grew up in a country, though fearful of nuclear attack, that fundamentally believed it was invulnerable. We now all know differently. The effects of 9/11 and the response to it may well define the world in which you live for your entire lives. The time nears to dismiss you from this assembly and from this college. I would be dishonest if I did not tell you that I fear for you. You have come of age in a nation in terrible decline. A depression in politics, in the economy, in our standing in the world that has been 30 years in the making. Many of you, possibly most, may face lives in straitened material circumstances, and I refer not primarily here to the current recession, but to the imminent ecological crises and what they may bring economically, and to the impossibility that the United States could continue to consume annually a disproportionate share of the world's goods. At present, we consume roughly 27% of the non-renewable energy in the world. And if you think about what fraction of the world's population we are, you understand whatever else that cannot be borne. You will have to live in a world of the whole globe, as no other American generation before you has, even those who fought in World War II. When you think of the gifts your education here has given you, look at a map of the world, country by country. Ask yourselves how much you've learned here about each of those countries on that map, their political and economic conditions, their populations, their cultures, their languages. The truth is, you couldn't have. Think about Indonesia, for example, the fourth largest country in the world, the largest Muslim country in the world, situated in one of the most strategic locations in the world. Yet for only these last 2 years of my nearly four decades at this college have there been any courses you could take on Indonesia. And for now, they will no longer be taught here, at least for the immediate future, because we're not keeping their teacher. This is called vision. Neither a college nor a country that does not recognize the world in which it lives can complain when it loses power and prestige. Our beloved country in the last 30 years has also become the most unequal in the industrial world. The top one-tenth of 1% of the population possesses 11% of the total incomes in this country, and the top 1% possesses almost 22%. The data on wealth holding is even more imbalanced. In the meantime, the standard of living for 60% of the population has declined since 1980. The availability of decent-paying jobs with benefits has shrunk drastically, and even the solidly middle-class population, the quartile between 60 and 80%, has maintained its standard of living only by going from households with one full-time earner to two. Surely a degradation in the standard of living in some ways. Officially, 16% of our population lives below the poverty line, but it's an absurd measure maintained by the federal government to minimize our awareness. By any realistic measure, the figure is closer to 30%. That is, people struggling every day to make it in the most minimal material ways. Now, I would submit to you that none of this has been an artifact of the so-called free market, which was never free, nor will it ever be, but of carefully orchestrated politics altering radically federal tax policies. If we do a quick snapshot of global inequality, it is yet more shocking, more inexcusable, if that is possible. The combined wealth of the richest 225 individuals in the world equals the income of the poorest half of the world's population. That is, approximately 3 billion people. 225 people equals about half the size of your class. 3 billion people live in desperate straits, in part because of that maldistribution. This, too, you will have to face. And if, by the way, you believe those 225 people earned this differential, think again, and hard, because very few certainly ever earned anything. Itemized as I have, all this can only be overwhelming. But it need not be. In what time have people, have Americans, lived without profound challenges? James found those in his time neither exhausting nor depressing, but a source of energy and exhilaration. And he was famous to all who knew him for being the sort of person who walked into a room and set everything vibrating by his presence. He was a small man, but it didn't matter. Miles Horton, the founder of the Highlander School and an important mover both in the labor movement of the 30s and the civil rights movement, put the matter thus. I think that people aren't fully free until they're in a struggle for justice. And that means for everyone. It's a struggle of such importance that they're willing, if necessary, to die for it. I think that's what you have to do before you're really free. Then you've got something to live for. The struggle is so important that it gives meaning to life. And that's really what Emerson and Thoreau and James say. It is only when we come to the point where we are thinking about our lives in a way that tells us we have a choice, a very stark choice, between dying or living. And that's a choice you will be facing. So, go from here, touch the world, and let it touch you in every way possible. Be full of life and love. Find pleasures in what possibilities you enable in others. Discover your talents and respect them. Face whatever you fear and go forth. May you have lives abounding. And may you join others to transform what you have inherited. Be full of all the joy that comes with the discovery each day that life indeed is worth living. Thank you.